Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today initially embarked on a career as an actress before turning her hand to writing, a surprising career for one who didn't read until the age of 10. Her first novel, Hideous Kinky, was shortlisted for the John Llewellyn Reese Prize and made into a film starring Kate Winslet. Following that, she went on to receive numerous awards, including making it onto the Granta Best Young British Novelist selection. She's since gone on to write numerous books and plays and also teaches creative writing at the Faber Academy. Her latest book, I Couldn't Love You More, explores a woman's journey through love, motherhood, secrets, and betrayal. Of course, the Freud name is incredibly well known, and I just wonder how much of an impact that's had on you.
It's so hard to tell what it would be like not to have the Freud name, but certainly for the first part of my life, it had no impact at all. I grew up in the country with my mother and sister. It never got mentioned. I never, have to be honest, it took me a very long, I'd never even heard of Sigmund Freud. No one mentioned it. My father wasn't so well known when I was younger. And maybe it really only comes up really in situations like this when I'm being interviewed and people were sort of curious about the, me, not just as myself, but as a sort of part of a wider world. So in my daily life, not really.
Have you had psychoanalysis?
Well, I've had therapy, but never actual psychoanalysis. And hurrah for therapy, thank God. That's all I can say.
Let's go back to the beginning then, because so much of your work seems to be semi-autobiographical. And your first book was Hideous Kinky, and I think that that's quite a good way of getting into what your early childhood was like.
Yes, so my first book was inspired very much by my really early childhood. I think a lot of writers are quite defensive about their books being framed as semi-autobiographical, because I think the idea behind it slightly feels as if maybe it's not so difficult to write a book if you're just telling your own story. But I always quite open about it because I am so damn curious about aspects of my life, about family members, about stories that have sort of fueled my imagination for so long that I'm really interested in the way you can kind of make something out of something else. So I'm very happy to acknowledge that the starting point for a lot of my books is something that is personal to me, but Hideous Kinky is quite a good example. So I was actually only 4 years old when we set off from Morocco, and I was six when we came back to live in England. Obviously, I didn't remember more than any... Well, I wrote down what I remembered, and it filled a page and a half. So it was just as difficult, if you like, a book to write as if I had sort of not experienced it in some ways. But maybe that's disingenuous, because what I did remember was the atmosphere. And I think that's what engaged people. And that's probably what no one could make up, is this sort of strange experience of being so different from everybody else that you're growing up with. You know, so we lived in the old part of Marrakesh, a little kind of riad in the Medina, in a room, and we wandered through the square. The square became our kind of playground, me and my sister. We befriended all the local children. And I suppose when you're always a little bit of an outsider in life, you start to watch, and I was always very watchful. I was always collecting stories and collecting images. I've actually got a wooden box that I was given for my fifth birthday that I kept treasures in, and I still have it, and it has pieces of braid, it has old coins, it has a little corduroy patch that was embroidered by my mother's boyfriend Bilal when my trousers tore, and I used that particular moment to create his character for Hideous Kinky. I thought, what kind of a man would do such a sweet thing? He sewed it onto my trousers, and when my trousers grew too small, I unpicked it and I put it in my box. So I've always collected stories.
And, I mean, that was a very peripatetic childhood. You came back to England and, in fact, didn't even read or write until you were much older.
Well, I was very distracted. I was absolutely caught up in the kind of visual kind of colour and vibrancy of living in North Africa. And I have to say, England in the early 70s was a very dull, dreary place. Everyone seemed to just live behind their closed front door. And we moved to Sussex, where we lived for 10 years. And it took me a while to catch up. I liked making things. I was good at sewing. I went to a Rudolf Steiner school where that was prized quite highly. So I was very good at what they called handwork, which was of knitting and crochet and weaving. And so I wasn't considered to be a complete dunce, but I was about 10 before I really mastered reading and writing. But once I did, then I was just reading absolutely everything. And so I think that when that happens to a child, they often catch up and then advance very quickly because they're absolutely ready.
After school, you still wanted to tell stories, but being a writer was not your obvious path at that point.
I was always thinking about what I'd like to do. For some reason, I needed to have a plan, and I hit upon the idea of being an actress quite early, about 12. I remember that because I was sent on a German exchange, and I remember when I was about 12 or 13, they said, what would you like to do when you grow up? And I said, ich will ein Schauspielerin sein, which I must have looked up so that I could tell them that I wanted to be an actress. So I remember that that's how I can date it. But yeah, so I left school when I was 16. And I came to London and embarked on sort of drama courses of various kind. I went to drama school and started being an actress. And it was while I was an actress that I started to write my own material. I teamed up with a friend who was at drama school with me, and we started to write sketches and songs and poems and perform them. And I started going to creative writing classes at the City Lit and writing a little bit about my childhood. And that definitely seemed to be something I felt I found a voice to tell that story. I started just very tentatively writing, you know, a few sentences, building up. And then when I was about 26, I felt utterly, utterly frustrated with my life in every way. I was single. I found acting completely frustrating because it didn't continue. You know, you do a job and it would end over and over again. And I thought, right, I'll just sit down and try and write this into a story. And I did.
And it's been marvellously successful. It was made into a film and so on. That was your first novel. That was Hideous Kinky. But then you went on to your second one, which was Peerless Flats. And that led to you being named one of Granta's best young writers.
Yes, that was very exciting. Everything happened very fast. It's funny, in writing, often everything happens incredibly slowly. But Hideous Kinky was sort of growing for years. And it took a long time to have the discipline, really, to sit down and write it. Peerless Flats, it was so exciting. After years of being an actress where you are always struggling to kind of get affirmation, Hideous Kinky, when it was bought and an agent said yes, a publisher said yes, someone in America said yes, I was so fueled with sort of affirmation and excitement and energy that I wrote Peerless Flats in about 5 months. I just couldn't believe. I remember walking down Portobello Road. I was living around in West London, and I bumped into a friend of my mother's, someone who'd actually come out to visit us in Morocco, one of the characters in my book. She had a little baby who was called Mob. I remember asking her when I was little, why is your baby called Mob? And she said, because her father's an anarchist, which I didn't see what was funny until I wrote that down, you know, 20 years later. And I bumped into this woman and she said, oh, I hear you wrote a book. And I said, yes, yes. And she said, what are you doing now? And I said, well, I'm writing another one. She said, another one? And I thought, I know, it's actually insane. But as it has continued for 30 years, it's very addictive writing. And I have found that I was totally addicted to the process of it ever since.
In Sea House, I see lots of sort of parallels with your brand, new book, in terms of time and having a lot of sort of different time strands and relationships and so on. Tell us a little bit more about Sea House.
Yes, that's interesting, actually. Well, what was really lovely about writing is that, you know, you often wonder, oh, I've got a book to write, but what if I'll never think of anything else? But each book, often it breeds another idea for a book. So my third book was a novel called Summer at Gaglow, and I'd used some of my family's, just little tiny little snippets of my family history. My father's mother's sort of rather bourgeois Jewish Berlin family and how patriotic and German they were and very unconnected to their Jewish roots during the First World War. So I was very interested in that, with this kind of shadow of what came after. But when I finished writing that book, my father, and actually even my Uncle Clement, who I hardly knew, people in my family, from my father's side, were just absolutely amazed that I'd sort of delved into their history and sort of recreated a part of their life using some of the characters. And as a result, people started to tell me all sorts of wonderful things, give me photographs, even some of the people's books that I'd used had translated, some of their relatives sent me memoirs, you know, this wonderful, wonderful influx. And one of the things that happened was that my father said, oh, I have a carrier bag full of letters between my parents. I took from, when my mother was dying, I took from the house, maybe you would like it. And he gave it to me. And I knew he was giving it to me with the idea that I would do something with it. There was no doubt about it. He saw me as somebody who liked to make things out of other things. And I was writing my fourth novel, The Wild, and I was finishing it, and I got so excited about these letters. And I remember spreading them all over my study floor and looking at the wonderful, beautiful handwriting. It turned out that they were actually all letters from my grandfather to my grandmother. She had obviously kept his letters. What had happened to her letters? Oh, I wish I had them. I don't know. But actually, one side of a correspondence tells you pretty much everything you need to know. And it had all the addresses. They'd met when they were in there. You know, she was 19, I think. She'd been a nurse in the First World War, and he'd been ill with tuberculosis. And they'd met. She was a very wealthy, very beautiful child of a bourgeois family. Obviously, he was the son of Sigmund Freud. But he sort of came into her family and moved to Berlin to be with her. And the Sea House really came out of those letters because they had such a passionate love affair. Mm. And I wanted to write about different aspects of love. And so I took a character sort of from now. Well, it was, I don't know what date I wrote that in, sort of 2000 or something. So there was a modern character who was researching an architect. My grandfather was an architect. And she discovers some letters. And so I, through the letters and the life of the architect that she researches and their life comes alive, she starts to really consider her own relationship and the way that love in her life really falls short compared to the sort of love that she reads about. Mm. And of course, my grandparents, well, of course, but very importantly for me, my grandparents, when they came to England in 1933, when Hitler became Chancellor, they left. They were absolutely ahead of the game and they got out. And they looked for a peaceful, idyllic place to spend their summers because they'd had a beautiful place in Germany on the Baltic coast, a little island called Hiddensee. And they found a village in Suffolk, which has been somewhere that the family have gone ever since, somewhere that I love very deeply. And I thought, this novel is going to give me a chance to set a novel in this village. Mm. Oh, my God, I had been storing up all the visual images and the sounds and the walks and the sea and the green and the wildlife, and it all poured out into that book. Out of all my novels, it's by far the most enjoyable that I ever wrote.
Interesting, though, that you, in fact, never met your father's parents.
No. Well, I never met his father or actually any member of his family until I was a teenager, when somebody in London who lived in the block of flats I was living in set up an introduction between me and my cousin Matthew. I was the first member of my father's family I met. My father was quite secretive and individual, as was my mother, and didn't think it was any priority in us meeting any. It was none of his family's business that he had various children. But I did actually meet his mother, who I looked so like that I think even my father thought, oh, come on, this is ridiculous. They must meet. She was very old by then, and she wasn't really herself. And we went for dinner. I didn't get the feeling she had any idea who I was. She was rather grand and quite sort of fierce, but it was nice to set eyes on her.
Your father's family and your mother's family couldn't have been more different in that your mother was from a very Catholic family.
Yes. So my mother came from a much more sort of traditional, you know, working middle-class Irish Catholic family. And she'd grown up in London. They ran a pub in Brixton. But they were always saving to go back to Ireland. And when she was a teenager, they sort of realised their dream. But she had already, by this point, sort of discovered London. And she'd gone to the coffee bars of Soho and dancing in Notting Hill. And she'd met my father. But they whisked her away anyway, even though she was desperate to stay in London. And she spent the last year of her education at a convent in Ireland. But as soon as she was able, she rushed back to England and embarked on this affair with my father. By the time she was 20, she had two children. But she didn't tell her parents that she had any children or that she was pregnant. I mean, it is interesting that neither of my parents told their parents they had children. And I suppose they would have eventually discovered. I don't know. She went back to visit when she was about 5 or 6 months pregnant with my older sister, and she says they didn't notice, and she just never went again. But when we came back from Morocco, there was some kind of coming together, and we met our grandparents. And, you know, what's so interesting, and I really try and explore this in my book, and it's so sort of tragic as well, is that the sort of blanket of shame around illegitimacy in the world at that time, particularly in Catholic Ireland, but, you know, everywhere in England too, was so powerful that, you know, my grandparents could have been denied ever having us as their grandchildren, who they took to their hearts totally as soon as they met us. Mm. And then we spent many, many wonderful holidays with them, and, you know, we're in touch with them until they died. And I have a whole box full of letters from my Nana saying, you know, please do find a way to come and visit, etc. They were all scattered with the initials PG, please God, or GW, God willing. Oh. Every sentence sort of had this as part of the sentence. Yeah.
I mean, so much of that origin story makes it into your new book, I Couldn't Love You More. And it's so beautiful, and it's written, it's structured very cleverly along these different sort of timelines. Perhaps you could talk us through that.
Well, the inspiration for this book, actually, it's funny that I'd forgotten about the Sea House and love, which wasn't the Sea House, really. I wanted to write about Suffolk. Love does come into it. But this book, I thought, I really want to write about the way that culturally women's lives have shifted, so that their focus of love is less on men in their lives, but on their children. I mean, it's almost been a sort of cult over the last sort of 20 years to be completely obsessed in a way that's not always useful for anyone, on their children. So I decided to initially start writing scenes from the lives of three different generations of women. And just for ease, I chose sort of someone of my grandmother's generation, my mother's and my own. So I started to write these scenes. It was great fun. Gosh, most of these did never end up in the book, but the wonderful, romantic and sexy and funny scenes of these women's lives as they sort of embark on relationships. But then I soon came to a grinding halt, as one often does with these things, and realised, OK, I need a story. I need to really focus on this. How am I going to merge it into something that has the energy to go right through? And so I started to really think a lot about my mother and the secret, something I hadn't really given so very much thought to, why she was compelled to keep her baby's secret. And I started to research sort of the background and the what-if story. What if she had have been discovered when she went to Ireland to be pregnant, and her family had of advised her to go and seek advice from the local priest, and she might have been told, well, if you go to the local mother and baby home, they'll help you. This is what girls were told. One 15-year-old girl was told, well, you'll get help with a pram. Once you enter the doors of these places, it's just so heartbreaking. You know, you're asked to change your name, you're stripped of your possessions, and they were forced to work unbelievably hard physically, far into their labours, sometimes tarring the roads, clipping the grass with nail scissors, washing the windows, working in the laundries. You know, we've probably seen the Magdalena laundry film. One of the bits of research uncovered that one of the girls whose story that was based on said it was so much worse than that film, which is a shocking film in itself. And I just found myself thinking, well, I think I'm going to write a story about what would have happened if my mother had have, you know, found herself on a different path. And so then I really had my story. So the beginnings of the story are very much rooted in my own sort of family history, but quite quickly it takes off into a completely different, all three of the storylines go off into fiction, but it's telling many people's story.
Mm. I loved the her lover, the father of her child, is this Jewish sculptor, with obvious parallels there, but yeah. The love between them seems so strong, and it was so heartbreaking when he turned away from her.
Yes, I really wanted to write, I was really clear that I did want at least one of the three stories to be a real, true love story, and to really allow myself to write the real romance. And I know that my mother was incredibly in love with my father and very, very happy for some years. And I thought that was really important to honour that these things, that love is such an incredibly powerful and wonderful and transformative thing. And I wanted I didn't want all the stories. I mean, Aoife's love for her husband too is very palpable. We meet Kate at a much more difficult part in her relationship. She sort of reflects back on earlier, happier times. So we have the sort of different elements. You know, we have a long marriage, we have a sort of burning affair, we have a sort of difficult sort of mid-marriage. So I was just looking at all the different areas of love.
And I guess when you were writing that, your own marriage was going through problems.
Yes, I think that it was one of the reasons why I wanted to write about love. When I started the book, my own marriage was felt as if it was really sort of falling apart. And I remember lying in bed one night, unable to sleep, as often is the case when you're very unhappy. I give this scene to Kate, actually, and I started thinking through all the people I'd ever sort of loved or been in a relationship with since the age of about, well, I was always in love with someone from age of about 3, but I think I started about 7 to make the episode in the book a little shorter, and just sort of looking and seeing if I could find a pattern and sort of seeing that actually the man I had ended up with, it was, you know, he was so much better than any of the other people that I had been involved with, and I was really lucky and grateful for that, but that somehow we'd got stuck and that I needed to sort of change everything. And so I was really, really looking at love and looking at the way I my relationship with my daughter had been affected by my marriage, and the way that my relationship, my mother's relationship with her daughters, had been so kind of informed by the fact that she wasn't able to be close to her mother. And so I sort of just started to kind of trace all these lines. And I think it was a timely book for me.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely loved it. I must just say that, and found it so refreshing in the way that you have a very light touch with all of these really deeply problematic relations and the way that you weave them together. And I just wonder how you sat down and did that structure.
Well, that is a very good question, because what I started out doing was I was incredibly excited to start this book, and I just started writing so freely and playfully. I just wrote a chapter here, another chapter. Some chapters were a page and a half, some chapters were 3 pages, some were long. Rosaline's story, sometimes it was in the 70s, sometimes it was here, it was back and forth. All the stories were out of time. And I thought, well, people will get this. It will be like a kind of crazy patchwork. But, oh my God, I got so tangled up. And I eventually had to stop, put all the stories in separate documents in chronological order so that it wasn't such hard work for the reader. It was completely incomprehensible, the first draft. I mean, it was about a 500-page long document of everything was skipping out of time. And there were all sorts of sort of cliffhangers of, but was that the day she lost her child? Like, what? Who's her child? What's going on? I mean, I could vaguely follow it. So I had to rein it back in. And it was really, really difficult book to pull together. Once I did, it seemed obvious. Like, well, of course, if I could have just written it like that, chronologically, each one interweaving. But it isn't how it came out. And I cut a lot of it out as well.
The one thing that really goes through it all is love, as we were saying. And we were chatting just before we began this interview about love and how, as you age, perhaps that changes. And I wonder if that's true for you.
I think that we are so informed by what we've seen. And I think especially for girls, if they have an unattainable father and they've seen their mother sort of struggle to catch hold of the coattails of love, it seems as if that's what love is. And I know for me, I always was attracted to men who were unavailable because it seemed so thrilling and exciting. And I also would challenge myself. I would be the one who would get them. And sometimes I did. And then it felt as if that's what love was. And it is, in some ways, absolutely a thrilling way to conduct a love affair. But it's exhausting. And it means that you don't get the deep pleasure of the comfort of love. You know, there's a questionnaire in one of the papers I often read is, what does love feel like? And I used to think, you know, terrifying and exhausting or whatever. But now I'm in a relationship with somebody who is really there. There's not a great will he, won't he atmosphere. And I see that love is comfort and joy and sweetness, and it's a very, very lovely thing to come to.
I mean, your marriage was to a very famous actor, and I wonder if that was part of the somebody who could never really be yours because he belongs to his audience and he's glamorous and possibly travelling, I don't know.
Well, I'm sure that was a lot of the attraction for me. I liked the idea of being with someone who was creating something because that's what I knew. And it meant he was always, you know, different, and wonderful things came into our lives. I'm sure it's why the marriage lasted for a very long time, because our lives and he were really interesting. And it was, I have to say, it wasn't boring. It just ultimately, it lacked comfort. And maybe I didn't need comfort so much when I was younger, and suddenly I really did need it. And so that shifted. Yes, it's hard to know. I'm sure there are actors who've managed to sustain wonderful, comforting marriages, but I didn't manage it.
And I think maybe one of the reasons I bring that up is because looking at your earlier work and then reading this book, there does seem to be a shift. You're the happiness of the author, or perhaps the contentment of the author, is much more present than in any of your other work.
That's so interesting, because in some ways it's a very, very traumatic story that I'm telling, and I found it really hard to write certainly some of Rosaline's experiences as she sort of goes through the system of the sort of Magdalena Laundrie's experience. I remember thinking, God, I've lost my ability to skip along with my writing. It feels as if I'm just grinding some kind of stone. And I worried, but when I finished it, I wrote a short story, it just flew out of my fingers, and I was so relieved that I hadn't lost that ability. And I think it pulled in two ways, this book. You know, yes, in lots of ways I was much happier, and maybe that gave the sort of breadth and strength to hold this story. But in some ways it didn't feel as if it was easy in any way to write.
Kate's happiness, I suppose. The way Kate deals with life is perhaps what I'm referring to. Or her unhappiness, even. The way you write the character.
Well, it was oddly enough, one of the hardest things to write was Kate. Because Kate's closer to me in terms of sort of chronology, and Kate is trapped in... It was very difficult not to make her feel too passive. In one of the earlier drafts, a friend of mine said, oh, I just wanted to slap her around the face. And I thought, okay, I haven't put something across that's really vital here, is that she's trying really hard to make this work. And it doesn't mean that you're passive if you're trying really hard to make something work. It might look like that from the outside. And I had to kind of mine very deep into her reasons for it. The fact that I had to remember every word that I wrote, that she had lost her mother and that she was wounded and she was determined to make something of her own work. And that led her astray. And there's a sort of moment of truth where she realises that she doesn't have to keep making something work that's completely unworkable, that there are other paths that she can follow. And I was really pleased with the way it came out, but I was quite lost in it for a while.
Mm. Well, it's absolutely undeniable that you have made something work. This book, I Couldn't Love You More, is beautiful and highly recommended. Esther Freud, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much.
Esther Freud, I Couldn't Love You More, is published by Bloomsbury. And if you'd like to see Esther in person and ask your own questions, we'll be continuing our discussion at the Wimbledon Book Festival on the 9th of June. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer Court. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.